very, very different from the typical Polish yeshiva, nothing at all, but meals, etc.
So Rav Meir Shapiro in the 1920s came to the United States on a fundraising mission. And remember, in the United States there were almost no yeshivas here. There were some Orthodox Jews, etc. And there were a few proposals. One proposal was to have a rabbinic exchange program where rabbis from Poland would spend a year in the United States, and some American rabbis would go to Poland. So Rav Meir Shapiro reputedly said, you know, we'll be happy to send you some of ours, but please don't send us. I mean, the truth of the matter is, to have an American rabbi then in Poland would have been very, very foolish. I mean, a Polish rabbi of even a small little village tended to know Shabbat. And Rav Moshe Feinstein was remarked, and this was not so far wrong, that he said, you know, in Europe, to get a job as a rav of a village, the basic requirement was to know the Shas and the Shulchan Aruch. That was it. You know, if you weren't a genius, you didn't have chidushim, you didn't have original interpretations, but you knew the basic materials. In America, you know Shas and Shulchan Aruch, you become the gadol hador. You become the greatest. So the truth of the matter is, a typical American rabbi, then and now, would be totally not able to function in a Polish congregation then. Mm-hmm. I mean, now you could send an American rabbi because there are very, very few Jews in Poland, and they tend not to be very learned. So any rabbi, you know, can help them. But anyway, the other thing that was brought up is he was once asked about his impressions about the American Jewish community. So he said he liked Americans a lot because he saw a certain enthusiasm, a certain fire, some excitement. Well, this was when the Young Israel movement began, when there were young people, you know, after the World War One generation, which largely left Yiddishkeit, but some of the children were finding their way back. You know, so it was very exciting. Still, you know, they had dancing. You know, it was a very different time in a sense for the Orthodox community. Young Israel's had, you know, mixed social dancing for a long time and things like that. But be it as it may, he made a statement that Americans are very good at making Kiddush, but they're not good at making Havdalah, meaning they sanctify, they embrace things, they want to elevate them. But Havdalah is the capacity to differentiate between the holy and the profane. And in other words, we like to embrace everything without recognizing that certain things perhaps have to be excluded sometimes. And he says that's Havdalah. And in fact, Chazal say that the ability of Havdalah, the ability to discriminate, is a sign of wisdom. Saturday night at Meiriv, when we say a special blessing about separating between holy and profane, which blessing of Shemoneh Esrei does that put into? Atachoneh, the blessing of knowledge. Because Chazal say, Yemein Das, if you don't have wisdom, Havdalah Minayin, how do you know how to differentiate? Mm-hmm. Right, so differentiating is a very great sign of wisdom. It's more acute, perhaps we could say, for those who identify, without getting into labels, with centrist Orthodoxy or modern Orthodoxy, whatever it is, because you know, if one takes the stance that I essentially try to reject as much of this world as I can, you know, I'll use a telephone and a fax machine, but I won't, you know, I don't get involved in the overall culture of the world. So in a sense, one's Avodas Hashem might be more pristine, might be more pure. It's easier, though, because it avoids the difficulty of discrimination. You kind of just say, everything out there is no good, and therefore, I create my environment. Now, one could say, based on what I said before, maybe that's the better way to go, because that way you're not in Nisayon, you're not in the test. On the other hand, the wisdom of being able to discriminate, like Rav Meir, but we're not Rav Meir, again, you see a lot of problems here. Rav Meir basically took the position, I will go to the source of wisdom, and I will be able to differentiate the elements that are evil from the stuff that is good. That, to a much lesser degree, perhaps, that is something that those of us who live in a modern culture have to do all the time. College, that is, you're right. If any of you get Jewish Action, you see there's a fascinating, in fact, a new issue just came out yesterday. A young girl, a high school senior, wrote an article about that she's going to Yale University. And she talked about the fact how it's so shocking, co-ed dorms. In fact, I understand there's a lawsuit now. But co-ed dorms and body piercings and everything else. And she talked about the fact that how a Jew has to be strong enough to be able to live a Torah life, even in that environment. This is what she wrote. So the next month, elicited, I feel sorry for her, she's a 17-year-old who gets these like three bomb letters from great, you know, Rabbanim, Moshe Eisman and Eretz Yisrael, and Rabbi Danziger in Washington Heights, like really heavy guns, just wrote very long letters. Because she was quoting from Shmuel Hirsch, who emphasizes Torah and Derech Eretz, combining Torah with living in the world. So they just wrote whole letters of this. Was not what Rav Hirsch says. Rav Hirsch admits that there are certain environments that you have to avoid.
Right.
And Rav Eisman wrote very, very long letters against this. So you see that this is kind of the struggle. Like Rav Eisman said, do you really feel the path to heaven has to run through New Haven? and then the Hillel rabbi of New Haven wrote in saying, my revered rabbi, Rabbi Eisman, doesn't realize we have the Hillel in the his thing. So it went into a whole discussion. But you see that college is the issue. Now, you know, the 20th century problem with college is not the same as the 19th century problem with college. That's why a lot of the old responses are not relevant. You know, the 19th century problem with college was, you're going to expose Jews to Plato and Aristotle, and they're going to be reading, you know, philosophical ideas like the problem that the Rambam was dealing with, and all of this philosophical speculation will cause people to come to these ideological oppositions to Torah. The truth is, you know, nobody reads Plato. I mean, you know, the point is, the problem of the modern campus is not one of intellectual ideas. The problem is the lifestyle, the lack of discipline, the lack of tzniyas. Mm-hmm. It's not the ideas, it's not the books, it's not any of that. It's the life.
Except it's also different in the 20th century because now you have to go to college in order to have a profession
The question then becomes, are there college environments which are less corrosive than others? One can argue about these things.
That's really true. There are some people that go just to religious schools where they do not do that. Yeah. They cannot find jobs even if they do. We have people that do not do that.
Right.
There are some.
Creating your own environment. Excuse me. Creating your own environment. It may be like an environment of Yerushalayim that is holy. If you don't even do, you can just go there.
Yeah.
Don't you find that even if you try to seclude yourself off, that the outside world intrudes anyway?
Well, in the type of life that we typically live in the United States.
No, but even if you live in, I don't know, Satmarland, it's
there's certainly something, but certain things are, nothing is hermetically sealed, but certain things have less intrusion than others, you know. There's low-level radiation and high-level radiation. Low-level radiation may get you eventually, but you have a much longer time till it does. But this is the difficult issue.
You're a professor at Maryland University, yeah? What about your students? Do you have students that also like this girl is describing it here?
No, law school tends to have more conservative populations. It happens to be. That happens to be true.
If they body pierce, they take them out of class.
Although, I'll tell you the truth, the gay and lesbian thing is certainly a big thing. When I got out of it, my dean asked me to be on a committee called Lifestyle Committee. Kind of how to make other, you know, lifestyles feel comfortable. So I went over and said, I mean, what are you doing this to me for? He says, I wanted there to be a counterbalance to what I know. But there was even a discussion about how we have to have sensitivity training sessions so that people will be more, you know, open to, you know, these things become like a mitzvah. You know, I mean, I have students of different persuasions. I mean, obviously, I don't discriminate. I don't grade the test any differently. Mm-hmm. But to kind of openly make things, you know, legitimate these things. So certainly, it's a very, very, and why you forget
even
about
even Cardozo.
Forget about University of Maryland, Cardozo.
Yeah.
Many Russian. It's not sectarian, but it's under Yeshiva University, and in order to get federal funding, they have to provide equal funding for gay and lesbian organizations.
I felt so sorry for Rabbi Lam.
And Rabbi
so
Lam was torn. Rabbi Lam is president of YU, and he's the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Yitzhak Rochana.
Yeah.
So he starts giving a whole thing, which I understand what he's doing, but many people do the thing. He says, well, I have two hats. I'm a Rosh Yeshiva, I'm a college president. As a Rosh Yeshiva, I condemn this. As a college president, I have to support it. Right. Says, and I'm doing this and this hat, and not that hat.
They have a right to be educated, but they don't have a right to interfere in normal citizens.
I understand, but the lines get very, very broken down.
Notre Dame been asked to do this in Israel. In other words, in Israel, they do take the sensitivity of the Orthodox, actually.
So, right? Sometimes. I mean, sometimes. Not always.
If you're here, let's say, in a restaurant, it's not only kosher, right? Not just the food.
Yeah.
If in Yerushalayim, a restaurant has kosher, right?
Yeah.
But you hear that a radio program is speaking about things not nice.
Right.
I bet you they would take away the kosher.
It depends on which organization certified.
The
Haredes. No, the Rabbanut's policy is they only certify the kosher ingredients. The Eda Haredes certifies the atmosphere.
You have to have both. One specializes in one, but to get the tailed out, you must have both, not just the kosher food.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It depends on the Tuda. There are different organizations in Eretz Yisrael. And the Rabbinate Tuda is limited to kosher of ingredients. The Eda Haredes Tuda, they'll yank a Tuda if there's dancing or something like that. They will not certify themselves.
It was interesting on the Cordoza thing, because at the same time, Notre Dame, I think, had the same issue.
That's right.
And they're
a
Catholic
right.
school.
And they stood up.
And they stood
that's
up.
Right.
But they're also, I was talking to my husband about it. He's like, but they didn't. Cordoza's in the middle of New York City. New York City has very strict laws.
So South Bend is one of the different things in New York.
But
it's a tremendous pressure.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, it goes back to the idea that, you know, like a conservative politician would say, once you accept government money, there are going to be strings, and there's not going to be freedom to make the moral decisions.
That's why we...
And this is really shocking. Going back to this parsha again, it talks about bribery.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when you take a bribe, your judgment is going to be impaired by definition. And bribes can be many forms.
That's why Reitz doesn't take much.
That's a what doesn't?
Reitz
that's
is the
rabbinical
school.
The rabbinical council. But the yeshiva university is a religious one. How can they accept
but the answer is they don't accept gay people for the Smicha program. But I mean, YU also has a medical school. It has a medical school and a law school. And
they accept
Goyim. And these are regular university schools.
But then they should not necessarily be judging normal people.
Well,
because they are colored by abnormal aspects.
There was a discussion whether YU should spin off its yeshiva and kind of make it a totally independent entity. Because that would almost destroy the raison d'etre of this university in the first place.
But if the government, let's say, would owe because they did covert studies or something, there should be no streams because they were not integrity reasons.
Okay, I understand. Let me just
get back to
Tokyo. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'll
do that.
Ethics and the moral values to the world, and what happens if we separate ourselves completely in the ghetto to fulfill our mitzvahs and
I understand that. That's the that's the argument for being involved. But you see, everything is balancing. The question is, if I go out, am I going to be a beacon of light and inspiration to the world, or Chas v'Shalom, am I going to be lowered because I can't maintain my standards? You know, for example, some consider the Amish on some level to be an inspiration. Of course, they have a lot of problems within the system because of, their family structure and everything else. So you can be an inspiration to the world sometimes, being separate too. People can look at the fact that the community doesn't have the same problems as society in terms of divorce and abuse and alcoholism, whatever the issues might be. So it is possible that separation and inspiration are not contradictory. One can create that situation.
Let's say Nathan Sharansky, he was not observant when he got in and went to the concentration camp in Russia, but he wanted to represent Jewish identity, so he started reading from the Siddur, and he
has
one little mitzvah, he risked his life for his Siddur, and that was great for the world. The world knows this story. So, and he was in a very hostile environment, and he could just so each person has to struggle.
Listen, Jews have always lived in the world. I mean, we're not talking about going to Mars. I mean, we're just talking about, do you seek out greater participation? or do you try to create a more pristine environment? Now, God, listen, Sharansky didn't choose to go to prison either. If you find yourself in a situation, you have to turn it into Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name. But the question is, when you, to whatever degree you have choices in your life, to what degree do you structure your choices in the direction of involvement, and to what degree do you structure your choices in the nature of separation? Now, many times you're not going to have the choices. Many times things are going to be dumped on you. Many times things are going to happen. And then you have to rise to the challenges that Hashem gives you. But our question is, in terms of a person's planning, because a person's planning never is final in any sense, but in terms of the direction I put for myself, where do I put my energies? And this is really the difficult balance. But anyway, I just want to go back to the Parsha Shavuot. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I just have to say, one problem that I've seen with separation, whether extreme or not, so extreme, is that people tend to think that judging people favorably, it's very hard to be raised in such an environment. And unless you make it a priority to love other Jews who are not in the same environment, because I see like kids who are brought up to believe this is the right way and we're doing the right thing, you have to make it a priority to imbue them with a sense that other Jews also have value, or that falls by the
reason. I think that's an excellent point. I think that separatism often leads to that, but it doesn't have to lead to that. It's possible to create a separatism which also has Avos Yisrael and connection. But very often they do come together in a negative way.
Right. If Avos Yisrael is really loved, focus on the community, to be mixed in the community, you can also turn on each other. Mm-hmm. And everybody else is doing the little thing, anybody who drives 5 miles faster, 5 miles an hour slower than me is, we're all the same thing in that. And if there's Avos Yisrael in the community, then they also look for people outside.
But anyway, that was the first point. Shavtu asam mishpat tzedek, the difference between judging others and judging yourself. Vishal Salantra used to say that when he was young, he thought he would change the world. And then he got older, and he thought he would just change his city. Then he thought he would limit himself to his family. And then he realized he could only change himself, and other things would follow automatically by that way. Listen, it's the same thing with everything, with our marriages or whatever it might be. We seem to be very, we have very good ideas as to what the other person is needs to do, but we often don't ask ourselves as to what it is that we can do, because the truth of the matter is we are the only ones who can make choices about our behavior. We cannot make choices about somebody else's behavior. The other thing is the next pasuk, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Righteousness, righteousness, shall you pursue? So first of all the Mefarshim talk about the double tzedek, tzedek tirdof. And one of the famous explanations that's given is that there are two forms of righteousness you must seek in life. One is righteousness of your ends, and the other is righteousness of your means in which you accomplish those ends. The double tzedek is the lesson that the means do not justify the ends. That one must look for ends which are righteous. One must seek them through honest means. Of course, we know already in this past year we've had tremendous desecration of God's name, in which people were trying to get money for very good causes, yeshivas and the like, and there was a certain amount of dishonesty and cheating that was involved. And besides the fact that that's theft and everything else, but that's certainly a violation of this idea of tzedek tzedek tirdof, that you don't use immoral means, even for good ends, because ultimately that creates a desecration of Hashem's name, and it really endangers the spiritual welfare. I was invited to give a talk somewhere on Jewish business ethics. So a Jewish man commented to me, there's just a bunch of attorneys, this is going to be the shortest talk on record, because I know there's not a lot to say. Jews and business ethics don't go together. And this comes from Jewish people that have this perception. One has to be very, very careful. The sins of Gezel are considered to be the most severe. The generation of the flood was wiped out because of, in spite of the fact they did everything, idol worship and immoral sexual activities, but the straw that broke the camel's back was their dishonesty in business with other people, their theft. And theft doesn't mean robbing. Theft includes things like you know, using office supplies for personal use, making local phone calls if that's against the office policy, all of that is theft. That is called gezel. One has to be very, very careful in that. But there's another explanation. That's one idea of tzedek. Tzedek is the means and the ends must be correct. The other, by the way, that goes to something else, too. I want to take it to a different point other than gezel. And this comes up a lot about the fact that, in a way, we're not supposed to worry about ends that much, the end product. Because whether our efforts bring success in whatever endeavor is up to Hashem. You see, a person might say, well, the only way I'll get this good end, the only way the yeshivas will get money, is if I do this. But Hashem's answer to that is, whether these things work or don't work is none of your business. You have to live your life on a day-to-day basis in accordance with the Ratzon Hashem. That ends is not our concern. Means is our concern. Ends is Hashem's concern. This is when the Kohanim got up in the roof of the Beis HaMikdash at the time of the Churban, and they threw their keys back to Hashem, and they said, if we can't keep this building up, it's your job. Now, this comes up, let me mention where this comes up in a totally different context. This comes up a lot with the issue about conservative and reform conversions. You know, it's a very hot issue right now. About the push in Eretz Israel to legitimize and recognize governmentally conservative reform conversions. And people say, well, you have to do this because otherwise there'll be a schism. Otherwise there'll be a separation. Otherwise we're going to lose thousands and thousands of Jews through intermarriage and the like. And what are we going to have? And by the year 2050, there'll be only 200,000 Jews in the world, and therefore we must do this to keep the Jewish people together. And some of our answer is, you know, in a way, whether there's going to be, you know, 2 million Jews, 200,000 Jews, or one Jew in the world, one does not compromise Hashem's will in order to achieve what one regards as a proper end, because it's really God's responsibility to determine, you know, whether there'll be Jews in the year 2050. One must follow the Ratzon Hashem. Okay, I'm not saying that it's always easy to determine what Hashem's will is. I'm not saying there's always one unequivocal answer. But certainly, if Halacha says that a certain thing is not proper, we cannot say that because we think it will contribute to the long-term survival of the Jewish people, we will therefore compromise it. Because the long-term survival of the Jewish people is more of God's responsibility than ours. We are obligated out. So if that means, as a result, decisions are made that will result in many, many Jews not being affiliated with Judaism, one has to make those decisions. Now, this is not to negate outreach and Avas Yisrael and trying to create bridges. But one cannot pull out the card by saying, you must do this because it's in the long-term survival of Klal Yisrael.
Yeah. But Rabbi, the Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, I think, said that if those who are converting in Israel, they are not born Jewish, those who are converting in Israel have to be done by the Orthodox. Those here, he's saying, that are already converted will be accepted as Jews concerning Israel.
That's not a final decision. That's his proposal. Yeah, similar to marriages. Well, essentially, it will be the same rule as for marriage. Yeah, and I understand. But again, there's a lot of agitation towards that. And
In terms of means towards the end, what about like Esther Hudit and a lot of people who seemingly violated halacha in order to basically save the Jewish people?
Well, you know, again, I mean, in a sense, within the halachic framework itself,
there are means
that are thereby legitimate. Let's take Bikuach Nefesh,
Shabbat.
Halachic framework recognized, in other words, the halacha itself gives you the green light or the red light. But to go beyond the halacha, now, the
truth is... Aren't you good at knowing she was right, though?
Well, that's like before the fact. Was a prostitute.
Those were
a temple outside of their faith. I mean, Tamar should dress up as a prostitute from her outside faith.
In a way, though, keep in mind that before the Torah was given, morality had a much more intuitive component. It's an interesting idea that the Torah, in effect, kind of took away some of the discretion that people had to make certain decisions. So you can't always draw
conclusions
before Matan Torah.
But you heard it, we can still
say. Well, yeah, but again, they say halakha itself will legitimate certain things.
Right.
Now, there are rare situations where the halakha itself gets suspended. For example, the writing down of the oral law. You know, the oral law, the Talmud was not allowed to be written down. But the Chachamim saw that there was a time in which everyone would forget it, and they permitted the writing down of the oral law, and they quoted a verse in Tehillim, Eis Lasos Lashem, when it's time to stand up for God, Hefei Retor Sech, you annul the law. But that's something that, once again...
That's also within halacha.
That's within halacha itself. But as I say, the notion of demographics, Jews are not governed by demographics. We can't automatically take demographic concerns. Because after all, you know, you might as well proclaim all of the Chinese Jewish, and then you'd have, you know, 1 billion more Jews. And besides, we're also discovering, by the way, talk about numbers, we're discovering all these populations that might be Jewish, right? They lost 10 tribes and everything, so it's almost as if Hashem is saying, don't worry, there'll be plenty, plenty more to come to. But, so it's kind of, you know, it's kind of offensive when people unilaterally make changes in what has been the Jewish standard for thousands of years, and then say, you better agree with my changes, or you're cutting us off from the Jewish people.
Yeah.
We haven't made any changes, we've just been doing the same thing. I mean, you know, again, it's a difficult situation.
I don't want to take a long time on this, but I really am bothered by why they're making such an issue of the conversions. When if somebody really wants a halakhic conversion, they can get it. There was all along they did that until there was an issue made. What really bothers me is the thing that's halakhically wrong, and that's what the divorce is. That I think that's what they should be working on. And not
about the problem of women who cannot get religious divorces, you mean?
Not only that, that they don't, if they do, some of them aren't getting proper divorces. And that is a real halachic issue. All along they were doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. That, you know, interestingly
they're
enough,
not worried about that.
Yeah, that was not a problem in the Reform movement, interestingly enough. It's very interesting. The Reform movement does not recognize gets. They just go with civil divorce. So many Reform rabbis would actually advise their congregants in order to prevent the problems of illegitimate children, go to an Orthodox rabbi and get a get, which is fine, to their credit. The problem is the conservative movement in recent years has begun to issue its own get, some of which may not be valid. It's not automatic, but because if the witnesses are not Shomer Shabbos, etc., the get would not be valid. So that's a very big danger, because women who get married without a get, you have a problem with a mamzer. That's a very, very serious problem, which has not come so much from the Reform circles as it has come from the conservative circles.
But some conservatives do get the get from Orthodox.
That was that had been the practice for many, many years until very recently. Still, many, many will still do it, but now conservatives...
Can I ask you a candle on your back?
Yeah.
If you can't use regular candles for some reason, but you usually do, can you get the electric and then plug it up and then make a bracha over that?
If you don't have candles that you light manually, you can make a bracha over electric candles.
Let's say you're
in a hospital, as an example.
No, no. Let's say you're in a hotel. You live in a hotel near Woodside, and they don't want the candle lighting in the room.
Yeah,
then you could use.
You could make a bracha on the electric.
Then somebody told me you could put on two lamps and then do that.
What do you mean by two lamps?
I'm not sure what they mean by two lamps.
Electric lamps.
Well, yes.
Two separate lamps.
Oh, yeah. In other words, Shabbos can. Yeah, it doesn't have to be, you know, the electric candelabra. You know, a lamp. A lamp would be a Shabbos. Could be a Shabbos candle too.
You mean you can actually turn on lamps?
Yeah.
But they would have to be together, not apart, right?
You should try to bring them together, but still.
So
you
know, then in that case, it would be better to use the electric thing. If you know that you usually do light the regular candles.
Yeah.
Let's say you're in a hotel that forbids.
Yeah. Well, then. Right. Okay, let me just go back. Yeah, I don't have to remember how I'm getting on all these candles today.
You're talking about getting.
Yeah, well, before that, I have to go back to the home page here. Okay. Tzedek said a tirdof, I was saying, the ends don't justify the means. But there's another explanation too. Tzedek, as I say, is a very interesting word. In fact, there's a book, I believe, written on the meaning of tzedek in Tanakh. And that is, tzedek is righteousness, tzedek is charity, but tzedek is also used, particularly in Yeshayahu, as victory, nitzachon. Nitzachon, because the victor has been exonerated, has been rights. And Tirdof is interesting. Tirdof implies chase. Now, when you're pursuing somebody, they're running away from you. So what is this tzedek that's running away from you? Chase it away. So they say, the desire to be victorious in arguments. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Chase away the tendency within a human personality to always be right. You know, one of the things we have is that in any argument, our position needs to be justified, needs to be exonerated. And sometimes a person could be 100% correct, but persevering in their attitude can cause destruction. And therefore, part of the warning of Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof is not to be so convinced that you have to be correct in every single argument or discussion. So Tzedek is Avas HaNitzachayim, the love of victory. Tirdof, chase it away, chase it away. And again, that would also be a very conducive attitude towards peace in one's environment, etc. Not to always feel that one has to be the victor. Shlomo Zalman Orbach recounts that, or it was recounted about him. But first of all, two things. One is the most amazing thing, that at the Levaya of his wife, which occurred around 10 years before his death, he said at the Levaya, he said, you know, it's customary to ask forgiveness from the mace. Yeah. But he says, in our 54 years, neither of us ever did anything to hurt the other. So we don't have to ask mechila. Amazing
thing. Isn't it too late when the person is dead already?
No, the halacha is very clear that if somebody dies and you have to make up with them, you should ask mechila in the presence of a minion. That's a halacha, in the presence of 10 people. But the other thing he said was, that he said that, I don't remember the whole story, that when they were in the Yichud room, when they got married and they were in Yichud, he said he had one request to make of her and he wanted her to agree to it before he would tell her what it was, because it was absolute. He says, you have to promise me you will agree to this without my even telling you what it is. And she said, okay, she agrees. So he told her later, whenever we have a disagreement, you're right. See, it's kind of, you know, you get a good surprise behind door one, door two. Right. So this was it. So
no wonder
this was,
it worked so much. Yeah.
Usually it's the opposite.
No, very opposite. Yeah. Yeah. First, yeah, but this is how he approached his life in that particular way. So that's Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof. The other remez to Elul is this, that we read in the Parsha, and of course the Torah talks about it in a few different places, that one who kills b'shogeg, if you kill somebody inadvertently, you have to go to the cities of refuge. Right? If I fall off a ladder and I kill somebody, I get exiled to the Orei Miklat. Now it's an interesting halacha. On one hand, the obligation to establish a court system, the Sanhedrin, does exist both in Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. There's a mitzvah to have a court system, a Jewish court system, both in the land of Israel and outside. In fact, even today, where we don't have the power to administer capital punishment and the like, there is a mitzvah, as you know, that all disputes between Jews must go to a beis din. I'm not allowed to sue you in civil court. If I want to sue you for something, I have to go to a beis din. If you refuse to go, then I'm permitted to go to civil court. This is even true, by the way, even for things like child custody and property divisions. That should not be. I mean, you could file for a civil divorce in civil court because you can't get a divorce. A basin gives you a get, but a basin cannot civilly dissolve your marriage. But all matters, according to halacha, of child custody and support should be decided either by agreement of the parties. I mean, if you agree, you don't have to go to a basin. Or by the basin. And what then is supposed to happen is, if the basin issues a decision, that is then presented to the civil court just for its approval, but it should not be decided by a judge. Now, what happens in the real world is, particularly when it comes to children, unfortunately, if a party is not happy with what the basin decided, they'll just go to court and try to have it set aside. Now, legally, they can do that.
Even if you decide that it's arbitration?
Yes, the reason is because even if you agree to submit a dispute to the arbitration of the beis din, but an arbitration order is not final regarding children. Really?
What about in Israel?
It's the best that you should tell. Israel is different. Israel is different because the Bat Din, the rabbinic courts, are given legal jurisdiction over custody and marriage and divorce matters. So Israel is different.
Family matters, not
yes, only family matters. In Israel, that would actually be the religious courts are part of the secular court system in Israel. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, you can go to a basin. If I'm suing you for money that you owe me, let's say. So we go to a basin, and the basin will make both of us sign an arbitration order that we accept the basin as a panel of arbitration. Now what that does is that when the basin issues a decision, then legally it is treated like the decision of an arbitrator, which a court will generally enforce unless there's some very unusual circumstances. So a decision of a basin in a commercial matter, if they signed an arbitration agreement and the basin will demand that they do so, can be enforced in a civil court. But a decision of a basin regarding child custody or visitation, even if there was an arbitration agreement, is not going to be enforced in a civil court in the United States, because even a regular arbitration doesn't do it, because every court has the freedom to determine what is in the best interest of the children. So legally, if you're not happy with the basin decision, you can go to court and try to challenge it. Halachically, however, it is still forbidden to do that. Halachically, the decision of the basin is religiously binding, even if it's not legally binding. Now, let me just mention some extreme examples how, although a basin is also supposed to look at what is in the best interest of the children, they're looking at the same thing, but I'll give you a very simple example where what a basin considers best interest of the children is not going to be the same always as to what a court. Let's consider a situation where you have a Jewish couple. Just to give you a legal hypothetical, a Jewish couple, they have a six-month-old baby, and the mother becomes a Jew for Jesus. She converts to Christianity. Now, insofar as a secular court is concerned, now it's one thing if the kid had been raised as a Jew maybe for 10 years, that would be a factor. But if it's a six-month-old baby, the baby has no religion, the court sees a father as one religion, the mother is another religion, there is absolutely no reason whatsoever why a father would get custody of a six-month-old baby. He would certainly give custody to the mother. And for the father to say, yes, but she's become a Christian, is totally irrelevant, because we simply have a Jew and a Christian. Obviously, a basin, again, it's a difficult situation. What do you do with a six-month-old baby? But a basin would have to rule that the child stays with the father, and then some arrangement would have to be made to ensure that the child is properly taken care of. Another example would be a private school tuition. This comes up a lot. This is really to the father's benefit. If there's a divorce and the mother has custody, and there are child support guidelines that a court awards, generally speaking, the court is not necessarily going to award private school tuition. Because the court says, listen, we have a public school system, and, you know, that's it. A basin would say the following. A father has a financial obligation to pay for the Jewish education of a son, of a child, son or daughter, and therefore what a woman would get as part of her child support would be full. You wouldn't even split it. The husband would have the obligation to pay 100% of the tuition. That is not the mother's halakhic obligation.
But at the time of conception, the time they got married, did they intend to raise a child Jewish? So that it's not a discrimination on if whether she should, the child should be raised Christian or Jew. What was the intention of the couple of a Jew?
Now, I understand that. Well, let's assume it was to raise the child Jewish. But my point is, if the child is just newly born, a court says, well, if the mother wants to change her mind, that's fine. And there's no particular... You're not uprooting the child from the way of life that he knew. Mm-hmm. See, that's the concern. The concern of a secular court is, are you uprooting the child from the stability of his environment? If the environment hasn't been established yet, a secular court says, Jewish, Christian, makes no difference to me. A basin would obviously say...
Oh, so the environment was Jewish to begin with.
Well, it's a better case. I'm not saying you would win there either, but certainly, if the child had already a conscious Jewish environment, a court could also look at that. So that would be a factor to look at.
Although they didn't insist on arbitration signing.
Yes,
today?
Yes, because they're not going to do something that
will
be wasted.
Right. Do communities that are separatist sign those as well? Like, will a Sogner based and sign it, or are they saying that that's... too much involved in the secular world.
I'm not sure what they do. I know, for example, in Washington and in Baltimore, they will not hear, basically refuse to take a case unless the parties have agreed to sign arbitration.
I once remember if a case is best in New York and you have that at stake, you're not bound.
No, no, that could still, well, what I said was that a Basin is supposed to be in the place of the defendant's residence. So if I get a summons from a Basin out of my state, I'm not obligated to respond to it. But if I did respond and they rendered a decision, then it would be going, and it could be enforced in Maryland as well. It's an interstate arbitration. Okay.
Well, I mean, in the case of, you know, with the private school support, I mean, you know, at least under civil law, then there's very strict, you know, you child support based upon income, and there's a schedule out there that you just
that's
go
correct.
Look at. So, I mean, does anybody ever actually do this? Would they do the vaping and
people do it, sure.
Okay.
I mean, I've been involved in cases where people do it.
But then the court should start returning and say, no, this is the schedule's child support.
No, that's not true. If the parties, what happens is the following: if the parties agree to the decision of the vaping, then the court will enter that decision as part of their judgment, and that supersedes the guidelines. If the parties have come, in other words, in effect, you're correct, it's not because, it's a subtle point, it's not because the court accepts the arbitration. They don't. But what's supposed to happen if both parties are amenable is they say, we agree to abide by the basis, and then the court enters that as its judgment. And, you know, that's possible. Now, if any of the parties wants to contest it, you're correct. For child support, they could break the guidelines.
Right. You're going to tell us about the Inali.
Yes.
Okay,
let me just get my point a little further, and then I'll be open to questions.
Can I ask for the arbitration again?
Yeah, okay.
Because arbitration, because I'm getting a civil divorce, so I'm interested in this.
Yeah.
Suppose someone is an Israeli citizen, they have an arbitral right to live in Israel.
Right.
And Israel says, no, not arbitration. Said it would be a case. Let's say, I don't know if he's going to Israel. Israel says, look, I don't want this person in arbitration. I want this thing settled. And the point is, you don't always have to have arbitration if it's possible to settle without
arbitration. Of course. The parties can always settle among themselves, yeah. Halakha doesn't prohibit that at all.
Israel can say, look, we have a say in that, and maybe they don't want it because for various reasons.
Well, you know, it depends on what the issue is. Certain issues...
Somebody is used to going to Rabbanim and Hilal Shlomo, and they say no.
They say no to what? To
arbitration. Suppose that they feel that it can be settled without arbitration. And under a different lawyer they had arbitration, but not under the current one.
You know, if the parties come to an agreement, that's fine. If they don't, then obviously the statement that they don't need arbitration is false. If it turns out to be a false statement.
Well, maybe they agreed on one part and maybe there's no need for, let's say, the alimony of other certain financial things.
Again, it depends on the issue. I can't address every possible issue right now, but you know, it all depends. If you want to talk to me privately, I'll be able to address
it. Well, I just wanted to say that general rule is not necessarily with rules 4 and 5 being suspended under general thing.
All right. Let me just go out. So the point we're making is that the Sanhedrin, a court system... A court system must exist. A Jewish court system halakhically must exist both in Eretz Israel and in Chutz La'aretz. And we are obligated to use that court system. That's one thing. And yet, the institution of Ir Miklat, even when there was a Beis HaMikdash, is limited to Eretz Israel, right? There were three, actually, how many Ir Miklat were there? There were actually 48. Actually 48.
Yeah,
because wait, three were Eivor LeYarden.
By Moses.
And three were in Eretz Yisrael proper. Hebron, by the way, was near Miklat. And then there were another 42 that were the cities of the Levian, which were also Ir Miklat. So Ir Miklat was a city of the Levian. Now, the Ir Miklat only exists in Eretz Yisrael. In Chutz La'aretz, if you murdered in Chutz La'aretz, you would be sent to an Ir Miklat in Eretz Yisrael. So why this dichotomy? Why is it so that the court system has to exist everywhere? But the penal system, as it were, is only Eretz Yisrael, the prison. So the Bavitcher Rebbe says very nicely, he says that when it comes to being judged, you have to be judged by a base that where you live. He quoted Pirkei Avos very literally. Al tadin es chavercha. Do not judge somebody. Ad shetagia limkomo till you're in his place. He says quite literally, you have to be judged by the judge of your place. Why is that? Because Eretz Yisrael, which has Kedusha, has prophecy, had a Beis HaMikdash, has the Shechina, they cannot stand in judgments on the people who live in Chutzal Aretz, who live a life of Hester Panim, of concealment of the Divine Presence. They don't see the Kedusha, they don't see the Ruchnius. They wouldn't know what the temptations are. And therefore, you need a Beis Din who is attuned to the time and the place of the situation of the sinner, because only they can weigh the pressures and the extenuating circumstances and the nisyonos and the trials. So when it comes to being judged, you need a Beis Din of your time and your place. But when it comes to the Eir Miklats, it works out this way. Why does a person have to go to an Eir Miklat? We talked about this a few weeks ago, I think. There are two reasons. One is, it's protective custody. You know, the Goel Adam can kill you. This is an environment in which you're safe. But there's another reason. It's not just protection. Because if it's just protection, you might decide, I'll hire my own guards, and I'll live...
Sort of a punishment, I guess.
Of course, we know people who live in armed mansions can still get killed in the street, like Versace a few weeks ago, but still, you know, a person might take his chances. The answer is you don't have a choice. Eir Miklat is not only protection. It is considered to be penance and atonement for the sin of killing. So people ask, but I did it accidentally. What do I need a kapara? What do I need a kapara for an inadvertent aveira? The answer is, by definition, killing somebody accidentally, really all aveiras accidentally, reflect a certain inadvertence, a carelessness, a negligence. In fact, the halakha is very clear. If something is truly an unavoidable accident, you don't go to the Eir Miklat. The Eir Miklat is the intermediate level. You're not intentional, but you were careless. You were cutting wood in a public place and the blade flew off the wood. Well, maybe you should have checked the blade first. You know, you threw a baseball and it hit somebody in the head. Right? These are things. So Mimela, when a person has become careless, when a person has become callous with regard to life, part of that is because a person gets dragged down by their environments. So the solution is not to spend more time in that environment. The solution is to leave that environment and enter an atmosphere of greater holiness. So you leave Chutz La'aretz, you go to Eretz Yisrael. And not just in Eretz Yisrael, but you go to the Eir Miklat. Who's in the Eir Miklat? Levium. Who are Levium? The teachers of Torah, spirituality. What are you supposed to learn in the Eir Miklat? Love of Hashem, love of Torah, love of Avas Yisrael. Those are the qualities that you learn. So it makes a lot of sense. To be judged, I need to be judged by somebody who knows what I've gone through. But when I finally need the kapara may require that you leave the environment. So the Svarim say that just as the Eir Miklat in Parshas Shoftim is the city of refuge that is situated in place, the month of Elul is the Eir Miklat of Zman. There is the Eir Miklat of place, and there is the Eir Miklat of time. That this is a city of refuge from what we do the rest of the year. And it's very interesting that one of the remazim, one of the allusions to the month of Elul, is in the Parsha of Eir Miklat. We know the famous allusion, we know it's from Shir HaShirim, Ani L'Dodi, I am for my beloved, V'Dodi Li, my beloved is for me. Ani, the first letter of those four words, spells out Elul, Elul. That's the famous remez. But there's a less known remez, which is in the Parsha of Orei Miklat. It says, Asher Loid Sada, he who did not kill with intention, V'Elokim Ina Liyada, God has prepared for him. V'Samti Lecha Makam, I have given you a place, Asher Yanus Shama, to which you can escape. And it says, Ina Liyada, V'Samti Lecha, God has prepared and given you. Elo, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Eir Miklat. So really, it's very, very clear that Elul is the place, the refuge that God has set aside for this year. And of course, comparing it to Eir Miklat is instructive on another level too, because in effect, what it's saying is, all of us are murderers. Who goes to an Eir Miklat? A Rotzeach. We have murdered. Who have we murdered? Well, there are a few possibilities. Chazal say that certain sins are considered to be like murder. When you humiliate somebody publicly, it is as if you have killed them. In fact, Tosfos says, goes so far as to say, now we don't pass him this way, it's a don't worry. It's very, very severe in halacha. We know that normally, if your life is in danger, Pikuach Nefesh allows you to transgress the Torah. But we know you can't kill an innocent person to save your life. In other words, if I go over to you and I say, kill him or I'll kill you, you can kill me because I'm a rodef, I'm threatening you, but you cannot kill an innocent person to save your own life. So what if the choice is, I tell you, humiliate somebody publicly or I'll kill you? So Tosfos says, very literally, taking it very literally, since humiliating somebody is as if you've killed them, you are obligated to give up your own life before you humiliate somebody publicly. And the proof Tosfos brings is a direct proof from Yehuda and Tamar. If you remember, when Yehuda was with Tamar, and Tamar was pregnant, and Yehuda didn't know, this was his daughter-in-law, and he thought that she committed adultery. And she sent to Yehuda the ring and the things that he had given her as a deposit. And Chazal say that if Yehuda would not have admitted his guilt, which he did, she would have allowed herself to be burnt to death before she would publicly embarrass him. So this is an amazing thing. That's one form of murder. But there's another form, which is why we go to the year Miklat, so to speak. That's right. There's another form of murder, and that's the murder we do to ourselves all the time. We have a neshama, and the neshama has potential for goodness and holiness. And as we waste the hours, the minutes, the hours, the days, the weeks, we are really killing off. Wasting time is suicide. Right? The life a person has is measured in terms of the time that they have. And therefore, all of us are rotzchim to a greater or lesser degree. And therefore, we go to the Yer Miklat. But, I guess the good side of it is, the Yer Miklat is not available for the mazik, for the intentional wrongdoer. The Yer Miklat is available for the unintentional. So in effect, Hashem says, that I know that's not really our intention. I know it's not your intention. I know that really a Jewish neshama wants to do good, but sometimes we are overcome. And therefore Hashem says, you are given the Yer Miklat, a velo, in which you can do tshuva and get a kapara. That's interesting about the Yer Miklat. I once read about Rav Aaron Cutler, great gadol reshiva of Lakewood, who was going around collecting money, and somebody once asked him, this is an amazing thing, why is it the lot of so many great gadolim, great Rosh Yeshiva, that they have to go from town to town, from house to house, like beggars, asking for money? So Rav Aaron said the following.
Not for themselves.
No, not for themselves, but they're
yeshiva.
You know. So Rav Aaron said the following thing. Rav Aaron said that every Rosh Yeshiva, every Rebbe, every teacher is potentially a murderer, because the charges that we have, the young neshamas that we have, if we don't behave the right way, if we're too harsh with them, if we destroy their self-esteem, if we take away their faith in themselves, we could destroy their neshama. So he says, Rosh Hashivas have to go into Golas. Rosh Hashivas have to go into exile because maybe they killed somebody. That's what he said. That's what Rav Aaron said. And therefore, there's a chiyuv of Golas because of what they may have done. It's an amazing thing. And he says it was Hashem's rachamim that they allowed the galus to be a kapar. Galus is an atonement. Whatever. Again, the Chazon Ish used to say, just to go about how severe it is when dealing with students, how one has to be so aware of how delicate the situation is. Whenever an issue came up regarding whether a certain child should be expelled from yeshiva or not, the Chazon Ish says, for this, you need a Beis Din of 23 judges. Because a Beis Din of 23 judges adjudicated capital punishment. So this is deciding a life. You need a Beis Din of 23 judges for these decisions. So this is what, again, you see, it's very delicate, particularly in the issue of expulsion, because you can't just say, well, we'll always err on the side of keeping people in. Because it's also true that certain people might be destructive forces. See, in fact, my Rosh Hashiva's policy is very, very simple. My Rosh Hashiva's policy always was, no matter how bad somebody was, you don't expel until the point to which they become influences on others. I mean, that's really the balance. Meaning to say, in terms of looking at the person as an individual, you always have to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, if there's any chance, one in a million chance, the person will benefit, you have to let him stay. But then the question becomes, there's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance he'll benefit, but there's a 1 in 5 chance other people are going to be influenced. So what's the sense of, you know, doing that? But just to show you...
When you say you're
Russian, you're Russian. We had situations over the years where people had to be asked to leave. You know, some people are trigger happy. They say, you know, the first irregularity, you know, kick them out. And his opinion always was that, you know, you don't keep you up. Just to give you an example of how the dichotomy has to be, your concern has to be for the influence, but not in terms of labeling the person. A story about the Chafetz Chaim, where a boy was asked to leave the yeshiva because he was involved in Haskalah, that's the Enlightenment. You know, kind of not reform per se, but he was involved with secular literature and not learning, and it was said he was a bad influence. So he was asked to leave the yeshiva. So he came to the Chafetz Chaim and said, you know, can I stay the night? The Chafetz Chaim said, no, you cannot even stay the night. I cannot allow you to stay 1 minute in this yeshiva. So the boy started leaving, you know, he was going to take the train. The Chafetz Chaim says, where are you going? He says, well, I'm going home. He says, oh no, you're going to stay with me. He says, I can't allow you to stay in the yeshiva dormitory because of influence, but you know, you're a Jew and I want to give you hospitality. You know, I want you to spend time. So the person was not religious Jew, but he said years later, he says, his whole life, he always supported Torah very generously because of Chafetz Chaim showed that it's not personal, so to speak. I can't have you there because of the influence, but you yourself are someone that I treasure and I want to take care of you to the best of my ability. So that's that difference, if you don't personalize it in that sense. So that's the idea of the Ir Mikvah Devela that I wanted to bring out as well. Let me just mention one other thing, just kind of a side thing. I mentioned some of this yesterday, just as a side halachic point. But those of you who teach Nach or learn Nach probably have this question. You know, one of the classic questions that the Mefarshim ask on Parsha Shoftim is, there is a mitzvah in the Torah that when the Jewish people come to Eretz Yisrael, they are supposed to appoint a king. It's counted as one of the 613 mitzvahs. Som tasim alecha melech. It's a mitzvah. So the classic question everybody asks is, that when the Jews come to Shmuel, and they ask Shmuel, let's have a king. And Shmuel says, Hashem is very upset with you because Hashem is your king. What do you need a king for? And the king will take your sons for servants and your women for maidservants, and there'll be taxes. He will oppress you, he will be unjust. And then he says, and I'll prove to you that Hashem is not happy with you. And he says, if Hashem is not happy with you, there should be a lightning storm in the middle of the spring, etc. And it all happened. So all the Mefarshim ask the question, if having a melech is a mitzvah, then why was Shmuel angry at Bnei Yisrael? And Hashem agreed with Shmuel. So first let me just mention that there's one opinion, the Abarbanel, who argues with all of Chazal. And the Abarbanel says, having a king is not a mitzvah, having a king is an aveira. And when it says, you shall make a king, that's if you ask for a king, that's what it says. If you ask for a king, Hasim alai melech, Hashem says you can have it. But not that it's a mitzvah, but it's a concession to your weakness. And the Abarbanel is a fascinating treatise in political theory, where the Abarbanel actually writes that he prefers the virtues of a republican form of government, representative form of government with limited terms of office than he does a monarchy. And it's very interesting, he draws out his own autobiographical experience. The Abarbanel was the finance minister to Isabella and Ferdinand of Columbus fame. The Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, the year Columbus set sail. And the Abarbanel was their finance minister, so he actually financed. He was in charge of raising money for the discovery of the New World. And he was given the option of staying. All the Jews were expelled from Spain, but Ferdinand needed him. He was his money man, so he gave the rishus to stay, but the Abarbanel obviously did not accept that offer. And he went into exile. First went to Portugal, and he eventually found his way to Italy. And in Italy, the different cities had their city-states. So he had great admiration, he writes, for Florence, Venice, and Genoa, which had city-states. He saw there was separation of powers, there was a legislative council, and a mayor, or a governor, whatever the title was, and they had term limits, they could only serve for a certain amount of time, and then they were replaced. And he said he liked this very much because people who could be replaced in elections, they felt very responsible and accountable to the electorate, because in a few years from that, they would be on the outside. Yeah. either running again or on the outside, and therefore, and he says he contrasted this with the despotism of Isabella and Ferdinand, who made all sorts of evil decrees that nobody could stop. So he was actually a big advocate for democracy and republican forms of government. But we have to admit, this is a das yachid, this is a single isolated view in rabbinic literature, which is not shared by the Rambam and Chazal, who talk about, so according to Barbanel, obviously, therefore there's no discrepancy at all between the Chumash and the Book of Shmuel. The Chumash says, if you ask for a king, you'll get it, but not that it's a good thing, and that's why Shmuel was so upset. I mean, according to Barbanel, it's very, very simple. But according to the Rambam and other commentaries, and the Gemara itself, which counts Melech as a mitzvah, so the question then becomes, what is the dissatisfaction? So, some people give an answer. Well, when they asked for a king, they said they want the king to chol ha-goyim. They want the king, not under a Torah framework, but like all the goyim, like the nations. But that's a very, very difficult answer, because the words chol ha-goyim appear in the Chumash itself. If you look at the Chumash, it says, when you say, Asima alai melech, I want to have a king, chol ha-goyim, Hashem then says, Shom tasim alecha melech. So it's difficult to say that the Chol HaGoyim is the bad thing, because that is also in the Chumash itself as part of the request. So the Drushas HaRan, again one of the Rishonim who lived in the 1400s, says that the evil thing is a melech has two functions, ideally. A melech is a political and military leader, that's one thing. But a melech, at least in the ancient world, we're not talking about the constitutional monarchies like England's, but a melech was also a lawmaker. The melech proclaimed the laws. Now, that is what the Torah doesn't want. In other words, the Torah says to have a melech as a political and military leader is fine, but the laws of the government should be the laws of the Torah. And therefore, he says, if you look in the book of Shmuel, it's very meduyah. They went to Shmuel and they said, let us have a king, not kichal, they ask for a melech to adjudicate us, to judge us. You see? If you just look at those two psukim, you see the Ran is almost explicit in the verse that the problem in their request was not kichol hagoyim, the problem was with shafteinu.
That's why we have kahuna and marshes, right?
That's right. So, which means this parsha differentiates. Right. Yeah. Certainly, that's another aspect of the melech. The fact that the melech always has a sefer Torah with him, one in his house and one with him, he carries it with him at all times, is that he should be reminded to be a role model. Obviously, right. That's very, very true. A symbolic role model. But the concept of separation of church and state, therefore, we do see it, but in a different way. Not that the state should be religiously indifferent. Obviously, a Torah state would be governed by the Torah. But that the leadership of the politics and the leadership of the religion should
should not be unified in a single person. And the Ramban writes, and this is so, because since political life corrupts a person with the desire for power and control, one's judgments will not be purely spiritual at that point. In other words, we see this in our Israel today, where the decisions that political parties make, religious political parties make, often are motivated by how much control will they have, how much money will they get, and it's not really pure spiritual truth. And therefore the Ramban talks about the need to separate, and that is the problem of the Shaftana, where you're collapsing the religious and the spiritual leadership. So separation of church and state is not to protect the state from the church, but it's to protect the church from the state. That political involvement is very corrupting on religious institutions and religious people, really. In fact, the Pope had a point, you know, a few years ago. Father Dreiner, who wasn't president of Georgetown, but he was a professor in Georgetown, was a member of Congress for many years. And the Pope issued a psak that priests are not allowed to be in Congress, and not allowed to be in government. And he resigned his seat. The Pope had a good point. Yeah, it's a good point. I guess the Ron's point is not that a king cannot be a judge, but the king, as it were, should not be the source of the laws by which you judge. I mean, the laws, in other words, what the halachos are, should be determined by the Sanhedrin. The king then applies the laws to individual cases. You see? Yeah. Well, Shlomo was considered to be the wisest of all people. So it's interesting, the Sanhedrin missed out, as it were, because he was not on the Sanhedrin. But generally speaking, a melech cannot be on the Sanhedrin. We differentiate the religious role from these political and secular role. Of course, Shlomo probably judged as an arbitrator, too. In fact, keep in mind that arbitration is a little different. This issue arises with women, too. A woman is not kosher to be on a beis din. So Tosfos asks the witness, or to be a judge on a beis din. So Tosfos asks the question, how could Devorah judge people? And the answer is, if both litigants agree to submit their disputes, they are free to designate anyone they want to be their judge. And therefore, even if a woman cannot be an official judge, a woman can function as a judge through the voluntary acceptance of the litigants. Now, this has some very, very far-reaching implications. One can make a case, therefore, that even the possibility of a woman rabbi, again, I don't want to get into all of the implications, but Tosfos is suggesting that when there is voluntary acceptance of everybody concerned, the limitations on women's authority tend not to apply if there is acceptance. So that's a very interesting thought that one can use in different ways.
She's having a bad time frame, but from the time of Deborah, a different time.
Yes.
And maybe she was called a judge not by being appointed judge, but by her wisdom.
Yes, but still, I mean, there are women of wisdom. Now, Tosfos gives another answer. That's correct. Well, Tosfos gives another answer which would destroy the relevance of Devorah to our situation. That is, Devorah was a prophetess, and therefore Hashem gave her the authorization. That, of course, would have little or no application to an age without prophecy. So there are different explanations Tosfos gives to how do we understand Devorah as a shofetess.
I mean, I'm just trying to think. Tosfos was, I mean, Rashi's daughters, I guess, were
Tosfos'
mothers.
Yeah, well, some of them. I mean, Tosfos includes hundreds of people, but yeah. The founders, Tosfos literally means additions. These are the marginal notes on the Talmud. Mm-hmm. And if you open up the page of Gemara, you'll see on the inner column is the commentary of Rashi, and on the outer column is the commentary of the Baalei HaTosfos, and the founders of the school of the Tosfos were Rashi's grandchildren. And their mothers, Rashi's daughter, Rashi only had daughters, were great, great scholars in their own rights, according to tradition. Mm-hmm. They used to teach Talmud, behind the veil, some say. And according to tradition, again, I'm not sure if it's been verified, some of the commentaries on certain tractates of the Talmud were actually written by Rashi's daughters. His grandson Walter Tosfos. They say that the commentary on tractate Nedarim was written by Rashi's daughters. Of course, just to show you how there's probably hidden prejudice. That's the only Rashi that we don't really study in Yeshiva. We learn another commentary that it's difficult to understand. No, because it's difficult.
Yeah, it's very difficult, right?
Yeah, so the one commentary. The Torah is about vows, but the text of it is very, very corrupt, and the Rashi commentary is considered to be very obscure. So literally, we don't learn that when we learn another commentary. Still, it's interesting.
It's a Rashi commentary?
Yeah.
So they wrote a Rashi?
They wrote the commentary that is where Rashi's commentary normally is. We don't have a Rashi.
Oh, okay.
We don't have one that was authored by Rashi himself.
Okay.
At least we lost it. Rashi himself, it is said, wrote his commentary in three editions.
Mm-hmm.
So certain Masechtos have a first edition Rashi, certain have a second edition. That's why there's a different difference in style. And, you know, they say Rashi's commentary, they say that somebody once got up and said he wanted to write a commentary incorporating all of the mysteries, all of the Kabbalistic secrets of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote a huge commentary that was volumes and volumes and volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And his Rebbe told him, you got to shorten it. So he shortened it, so instead of being 100 volumes, it was 50 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked on it, shortened it. Finally, he came up with Rashi. What he was left with was exactly Rashi's commentary. So in Rashi's commentary, there are many, many mysteries and multiple levels of meaning. And again, I don't know how many of you have learned Gemara, but you see in Gemara too, I mean, it really is true that, you know, you read a line of Gemara sometimes, it's totally incomprehensible, and Rashi can clarify it in six words.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder, where did he get this? You know, you really get a sense of Ruach HaKodesh. See, in Chumash, it's not the same, because Chumash, you know, you could read a Pasuk Chumash, and you could at least understand what it says,
mm-hmm.
and then Rashi adds many dimensions. And in the Talmud, I mean, you literally would be totally, totally adrift.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really like having somebody hold your hand or
mm-hmm.
take you through. You really feel a very personal connection in that sense. Okay, maybe we'll stop here.
Yeah.
Thank you. We'll continue with our LA discussions next week. Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, so we
should
really
have
a lot of
your
very attention.
Thank you. Have a good trip. Have a good trip. Yes, yes. Thank you.
Let's assume you wait before you file a carryback claim for year one. You wait until when? Well, let's assume you wait until 11, 15, year six. It arose in your statute still open, even though it's only 3 years. It's open as long as it's year four assessment date. Year 4 date is open until turn 315.5 is open until March 15.3. Does everybody understand that? If not, we'll do it. Alright. Why you return to year 4? When? On March 15th, year 5. The service was 3 years within which to assess the tax in year four. March 15, year eight. Okay? And that's section 6501. You have the right to file a refund for the year four loss at any time on or before March 15th, year 8 also. And section 6511. Go through that. And if the year 4 resulted in a carryback, it opens up and continues to open people from year 1 up until March 15th. The year which was the source of the NOL. Alright, now, if you wait, I'd say 11, day 16, year 6, within which to file a claim for refund, distributed with this NOL carryback back to year 1. And the service pays you within 45 days to get it. Pay within 45 days after you filed it on 11/16/16. If they fail to pay you within 45 days of 11/16/16, you file the net operating loss carryback. If they fail to do it, they owe you interest from March 15th. And this is 45 days, and they interest back to March. That's interest on there. So what we can see, and this is just the beginning of the conversation, is that interest with regard to the year as 25 day rule with regard to the original return, not with regard to claims for refund, especially with regard to the operating loss carrybacks, statute of limitations is open and 45 day rule, and then there are other 30 other complications here which we'll get into now. So I need you to understand the complication is even more dramatic with regard to foreign tax credits. Foreign tax credits have a whole other mechanism for calculating them, and I won't get into it, except that the floor case in the notes recently decided suggests that there is a new regime that ought to be applied in regard to foreign tax credits distinguished from every other credit out there, R&D, investment credit, and the list goes on. All of those credits have a different mechanism for calculating interest except for foreign tax credit, which has a bit more beneficial mechanism for calculating the amount of tax credit. Even for case, in other words, in a wide diversity now, there are a couple of cases which are outstanding, which I haven't mentioned. Let me sort of just mention
briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rate that they use, is that determined on the filing date, the 315? Or is it the 1116, right? The rate of interest.
The
the rate that they publish, period, and you're entitled to it. So that if you file your refund claim on 1166, that's irrelevant. The interest begins on March 15th, you're filed. You figure out what the rate is on that date until the rate changes. And then you change it, brings you back to 1116, you're 6, that's fine. So whenever you begin to calculate the interest, if they owe you $10,000 as of March 15th, year 2, you look at the applicable rate with regard to that period. Interest, the mechanism by which the rate is calculated is set forth in Section 66.1. We are a couple of cases. First is Cirillo, which is first commission, which is the Third Circuit. Let's assume that you file a return, which is in some way an error, and you are criminally convicted with respect to your conduct. Does that foreclose you from contesting all of the penalties that are raised with you there? In other words, are you stopped as a result of a criminal conviction from contesting the Cirillo deals with a willful failure to file a timely return, which creates criminal liability. And the Court of Appeals in the Third Circuit standard now says even if you're convicted criminally for willful failure to file a timely return, it does not in and of itself establish liability for the fraud penalty because the fraud penalty now encompasses it is only imposed where proof of the deficiency is supplemented by proof that the deficiency is due to fraud with intent to evade tax, and that's not the standard for a failure to file a return. Tomlinson versus Lefkowitz involved a taxpayer who had been criminally willfully attempting to evade tax. And the court concluded that that criminal conviction, willful attempt to evade tax, determines that the deficiency is due to fraud, which attempts to evade tax, and that a taxpayer on the civil side after such a conviction is collaterally stopped as a result of the criminal conviction proceeding for a penalty assessment which might be. All right, that's the return on subject. Complicated area, lots of failures, lots of penalties, dealing with this issue continuously. Addition of standards by the return of the mission. What I now turn to is the section which I meant to start today. And this is the part of controversy dealing with the Internal Revenue Service at the administrative level, not the legal level, but the administrative level. we need to lay the predicate foundation. The first question that sort of pops to mind with regard to this is, do I do this? What's the likelihood that they're going to get the return that I have prepared, or the return with respect to the taxpayer to do this? And the answer is that all of us have been subject to an audit. If an audit is designed, if let's say you can find it in any region of the return, and that's not what I mean by audit, so that was all individual returns are valid. The form for execution matter, that's not a return. A return is a review, in-depth review of return, process, examination, and so on. All individual returns are checked for mathematical errors. You entitled to refunds, you get it. If you owe money because you added it wrong, I'll send you a notice. Do no statutory notice deficiency necessary with regard to mathematical errors. It's only substantive errors that result in individuals do not screen returns in general. It's done by a computer. Selected items from every return and files are placed on the computer to verify. The IRS's budget, 20-30%, attributable to the audits and the fund. One would initially think from policy point of view that the best way to achieve compliance is through the audit process begin to lower the threat of your returns to the bank. But that is not the purpose. It believes that the best way to achieve compliance with the Internal Revenue Office is through other mechanisms besides the audit process. They think that if there's withholding with regard to income, that will result in 99% compliance in a single situation where there's no withholding, and you may estimate a tax. Second is, audits can't be used efficiently for many reasons. Your return, for example, claims a personal exemption or dependent, but it's wrong. Come out and audit you and disallow that with regard to your return, but the service itself is the return itself. And they require you to respond to questions about your return and about the particular subject you're talking about, your dependent. So, you put down 5 dependents. That's all that was required in 1950. How many dependents do you have? 5. Okay? Now, they require you to list the names of the dependents. I mean, you can put 5 because you had 3 children, your spouse, and 2, and you just made mistakes. Now, they require you to put the names of those dependents on the return so that you can't make the error that you did make. 10 give 8, or whatever the number of children that is true that many people who are claiming dependents, exemptions, which they are not eligible for. Go out and audit that person. That's what they did at the end of the return and require you to answer questions regarding them. You have a vacation home, boat, airplane, foreign bank account, audit all those issues, check a box. And if you do, that puts you on fast road to an audit if you have those. Check that information. They don't talk with you, deal with you in general, and sort of understand. Okay? So you
your mechanism of holding executives putting questions on them, using your name, ask those questions so they can avoid the audit, they can inform you. Think about whether you're entitled to claim what you're claiming or something. That's our reserves. 50% approximately plus returns selected by means of machines. No specific judgments. The remainder are comprised of tax returns prepared. Big boom. If you're one of the lesser taxpayers who return the inherent tax return fair, your service is now investigating, you may be audited in the future. You have a claim brief from the end of the term. That may trigger an audit from your income. A related taxpayer, related to somebody, the company that's being audited, your shareholder is the best, your beneficiary of the trust, related taxpayers are apt to be brought in to provide service audits you for 1 year and says, when you die, I'll say, this is rapture your company. You claim that audit you for a second year, they expand corporate return from 1 year, 2, 3, 4, and that may be the trigger after having to be the gamblers, physicians, generally highlighted in some years. There have been partnerships in the years of risk management. Why are returns, some returns, elected, audited, from 20 years ago? Prior to 1960, most returns were audited manually. Individual classes were assigned a job in different directions on pulling returns, screening them, and then deciding whether this return was an apt subject for review. First, the manual process was a good mechanism to return the poor use of people. There was no uniformity. Somebody who was upset, that person, tragedy, poor, and poor full return, more return. So there was no uniformity with regard to the viewer. One interview was another, especially in different parts of the country. And finally, they could only screen a quarter of all the returns and millions and millions of returns. And the IRS wanted a mechanism for dividing returns into one category were those returns which had a huge potential resulting in audit issues and deficiencies. The other category of those returns which didn't have any little, minimal possibility of raising the proposed. And the item which best separates returns into one category, lots of potential versus little potential, those items, they wanted to find out what they were. And those items which help to differentiate those items from one category to the other is what they were trying to utilize in connection with the analysis of which returns to some of the other possibilities. We don't know what they are. Yes, that it's your just income, whether it's royalties, whether it's appreciation in connection with the return that you file, whether it's repair expenses, filing status, reduction amount, the list goes on. Those factors which help differentiate were utilized at the beginning, and the beginning of 1960s to be used on the process by which these factors were weighted and utilized by the service in selecting returns for a lot is known as discriminant function analysis. Discriminant function analysis, and that is known as the DIF, D-I-F system. And the DIF system, which again, 50% of the returns, like the computer, measures the possibility, probability of tax error on each return, and you'll give the signs weights to significant tax return line items and certain characteristics between them that are characteristic of the returns of the spot and the class of errors, and they assign weights to all of these characteristics and relate some weights. If you get a high score, you win. And you get an audit. And if you get a low score, you're not audited in general objection to the returns. Now, if you were the IRS, you were the rich, and you said to yourself, which returns do I want? You were under this category of those dip factors which result in huge, huge deficiencies in the returns. And if you did that, you'd be wrong. Because you have this category only with no change, which is the huge category of everybody who does it. And to the extent that you pooled all your resources, applied it to that category, the lots of returns, you'd soon find that this category with no changes at all is going to recognize that there's an equal threat out there, and they'll begin this massive problem to adopt this crude item conversion. What you want to do is take a vast amount of resources that category, and then allocate enough resources to this so that there is still that interim threat of a super audit with regard to all these things. And that's exactly what we're doing with these sort of things. And the number of returns that are audited dropping from the end of the year, 101%. Now, everyone sees the statistics and says, up to 1.7%, from under 1%, right. The number now includes service center audits, partial reviews, and replacement of the bottom line numbers from the IRS reports in the case. The amount of review of returns in general includes the recent budget issues. Now, you want to know what the no change is in connection with returns. And what you're trying to do is select the low returns, lots of changes, to spread out low returns, and generally decrease, gradually decrease the number of no change returns so that when you hit, you get a very, very result in connection with low returns. And there are a lot of statistics out there dealing with those returns. If you want to be aware, what you want to do is achieve the most of the dollar in connection. Now, a lot of returns, corporate returns, a lot of returns, individual. There are two types of returns. There's the office audit, and then there's a field audit. Let's take the office. The office audit is comprised of two subjects. You're calling from the IRS office, and they say, Elser, let me look at your returns. Let me see this documentation. So you're going into the Internal Revenue Service in their office and have your returns and returns. The second category is correspondence. That also is an office audit, by definition. And that's when the servicer writes you a letter and says, look, you match the 1099 against your return. Another one there, handle it by correspondence, you get a letter, and handle it. You off the field audit is where an agent goes out and examines your books and records of your credit card. It's usually done in connection with corporate, large proprietorships, partnerships with service reviews, with complex issues. Having said all of this, recognize that there are aberrations in the system. Sometimes the Internal Revenue said, we're going to throw a lot of our resources into those returns because they're easy to audit, and we have to jack up our audit numbers so we get more money from Congress. We've done that, chastised by the General Accounting Office in some recent report. And as a result, keep in mind that even though the audits are up, there's an indication that those audits are going to service in the audits and distinguish them from the normal audits. Next week, we'll sort of begin to talk about how ours arise, what the selection process is brought us, and then we'll talk about how we can handle audits, how ours are sampling agent, what the standards are, what the connection with administrative summons enforcement power, along the civil side, and we'll begin what I think is going to be something very interesting. Thank you.